evening, everyone. Thank you very much for joining us at this event on Ukraine and the EU and how the war in Ukraine is affecting and changing our perspectives and relations and how the sanctions work, etc. The war in Ukraine, I think, leaves no one untouched. First of all, of course, and importantly, on a personal level. But we're also rapidly discovering that this will probably be none of us untouched also on a professional level, as the legal ramifications of this war look to be far-reaching and really sort of game-changing in a number of fields. And one of those prominent fields there is obviously EU law. It's on the doorstep, and there are lots of close connections there. So this is what we're going to be exploring today. And I'm delighted to be joined by three real experts in EU law to help this conversation along. What I'm going to do is I'm going to briefly introduce them now in succession, and then give you a couple of, give you a bit of information of how the event is going to unfold. And then we're going to kick off. But so our speakers are, in order of appearance, Giulia Gentile. And Giulia is an LSE Law Fellow who's joined us from Maastricht University, I believe. Yes, where she was postdoctoral fellow and also a lecturer. Giulia had a lot of her training and education just across the road in King's College London. And in addition to all her impressive academic work on EU law, constitutional issues, citizenship, etc., she also has experience in legal practice, is admitted to the Italian bar. So she has a broad range of insights to bring. And then next to her, our second speaker is Jan Zgielinski. And Jan is a colleague of ours at the law school as well. He is an assistant professor of law. He has joined us from the University of Oxford. I think, Jan, you've also, you know, he's got lots of big names on his resume. He's also done, I think, a visiting researcher stint at Yale, was it? Yale Law School. And Jan, again, an expert on EU law, EU constitutional legal issues, etc., and also internal market and principles of general principles of EU law. And Giulia, by the way, Giulia will be addressing the sanctions primarily, the sanctions that the EU has imposed. And Jan, you will be looking at the kind of national dynamics, the kind of the way member states feed into the process, etc., and maybe also a little bit about football, because that's, you know, we sport is important. And then last but not least, we have Floris de Witte. Floris is an associate professor at the LSE Law School. And I'm sure that Floris also has an important pedigree elsewhere. But Floris is a bit of an LSE addict. He's been here, you know, as a fellow, you were already here as a PhD student for part of the time, I think, doing work. So we've had Floris with us and we've benefited from his wisdom on matters such as EU law, and particularly also issues of citizenship and EU and identity for a number of years. And Floris is going to round out the conversation by looking at the broader picture of how is this war changing, basically the politics, the law and politics of the EU generally. Okay, so those are the three presentations that we have. Our speakers are going to all aim for 10 minutes, which hopefully will keep them properly within the 15 minutes ballpark. And after that, we're going to have a Q&A. With the Q&A, you know, first of all, I'm going to take a couple of questions at each time, and then we'll turn back to the panel for discussion. The usual kind of rules apply in that, please, you know, ask questions. This is not the right venue to start monologuing. There are plentiful other venues for that on social media, etc. So please keep your questions short and pithy and to the point. And then the second request, and this is one that's a little bit more, I think, tailored to this particular event. You know, I would request that we all adopt some version of a veil of ignorance, in the sense that we don't know what the background is, what the experiences have been, what the family relations are of the people sitting around us, sitting next to us. Please be sensitive to that, be aware of these and in how you kind of express yourself. So be aware of the fact that, you know, we want here to have a sort of convivial and productive sharing of view and productive debate. And we all have to feel comfortable in that debate, and that's important. Okay, and with that, I think those are the key points for me to mention. So without further ado, we're going to kick off, and Julia, I'm happy to give you the floor.
Thank you very much, Verde, and good evening, everyone. So when discussing with Floris and Jan about issues to cover today, the list was already extremely long, but I believe that interestingly and perhaps unsurprisingly is going to become even longer. But today, as anticipated already by Verle, I'm going to cover in particular two matters. So sanctions, and this is something that we will explore from different aspects. So I will briefly touch upon their adoption, their effectiveness, and also future legal questions that are arising from the sanctions that have been imposed on Russia as a result of the conflict in Ukraine. And then I will move on to humanitarian aid. So we will explore briefly what has been the role and the action of the European Union in this respect, how the European Union is supporting Ukraine to face the conflict. So of course, it goes without saying, I will be adopting a ULO perspective. So of course, this is a partial perspective, one can say. So we need to bear this in mind. So I'll start with sanctions then. So just by way of a brief introduction, what are sanctions? So sanctions are measures that consist mostly of restrictions on trade, investment, restriction on investment, or also travel bans for individuals. And these are tools that are pivotal for the EU foreign policy. So the EU uses sanctions, uses restrictive measures to pursue the fundamental values that underpin the EU legal order, but in particular the EU foreign policy. And these values include also the rule of law. These measures are issued following the adoption of a decision by the Council. The Council acts in this context by unanimity. And then based on this decision, there will be a regulation that is adopted again by the Council, but on the basis of qualified majority. And the legal basis for these measures are Article 29 TU and Article 215 TFU. But nevertheless, this doesn't mean that if there are measures that are not covered by these provisions, the European Union cannot adopt them. The restrictive measures can also go beyond the remit, for example, of Article 215 TFU. So what about the sanctions imposed on Russia? So as a general comment, as a general overview, I think that it is quite accurate to say that the European Union has been quite swift and prompt in adopting these measures. And in fact, we can count four packages adopted in the context of a very, I would say, complex moment and also in a very short timeframe. So the first package was adopted on the 23rd of February, 2022. And this package includes some measures that were adopted in particular as a result of the Russia decision to recognize the independence of the non-government controlled areas of Donetsk and Luhansk oblasts. And in particular, the package includes sanctions against 351 members of the Russian state Duma who voted in favor of this recognition, but also restriction on economic relations with non-government controlled area of the Donetsk and Luhansk oblasts, and more in general, also restrictions to access to the EU capital and financial markets. Then the second package came quite shortly after, on 25th of February, 2022. And this package includes sanctions directly imposed on Russia's president, Vladimir Putin, and its foreign affairs minister, Sergei Lavrov, in response to the military aggression carried out by the Russian Federation against Ukraine. The EU imposed also restrictive measures on the members of the National Security Council of the Russian Federation and on the remaining members of the Russian state of Duma, who supported Russia recognition of the self-proclaimed Donetsk and Luhansk republics. The Council has agreed also on a further package of individual and economic restrictive measures, and these include finance, energy, transport, and technology sectors of Russia, as well as visa policies. Then the third and fourth package move on, and in my view have been quite remarkable, quite bold, one can say, because in particular, the third package adopted on the 28th of February, so 3 days after the previous one, include a swift ban for seven Russian banks. And we should say that this kind of sanction has been adopted by the European Union only in 2012. So this is the second time that the European Union has adopted this kind of measure in 2012 against Iran. Another measure is the suspension of the broadcasting in the EU of state-owned media Russia Today and Sputnik. And I will spend a few words on this measure in particular, because it's quite interesting. And then again, other measures of individual nature, of economic nature, against also Belarus. And finally, a ban on the transactions with the Russian Central Bank. And finally, we have the fourth package adopted just a few days ago on the 2nd of March 2022, which builds on the third package and expands the restriction on financial transactions through SWIFT. SWIFT, as you might know, I haven't said it because I was giving it as well known, but SWIFT is the main way, which is the main instrument that is used for financial transaction on a global level. And in fact, Russian transactions through SWIFT account for 1.5% of the global number of transactions carried through SWIFT. But the restriction of this fourth package also includes limitations on the export of marine navigation and radio communication technology to Russia, and prohibition on transaction with the Central Bank of Belarus. So having had this overview on the sanctions, I would like to spend a few words on their adoption, their effectiveness, and also future legal questions that we will be dealing with. So starting from adoption, well, as already briefly mentioned, I think that we can agree that we can converge with the view that the European Union has been rather swift in adopting these measures. However, there has been, generally speaking, before reaching an agreement on these measures, some discussion and also some, of course, divergence in the position of the different member states. So, for example, The Guardian reported that at a meeting of the leaders of the G7 group of nations on the 24th of February 2022, only Canada supported a call for a swift ban against Russia. And then some other member states, such as Netherlands, Germany, Cyprus, and Italy, were more cautious in this respect. But nevertheless, an agreement was achieved on the 26th of February 2022. So overall, one can say that in spite of the complexity of the situation and also the different views of the member states regarding the operations of Russia in Ukraine, there has been some unity. So in a way, the European Union, we could say, came quite strengthened out of this process, the adoption of sanctions. What about effectiveness of sanctions? Well, this is a topic that has been extensively discussed. So there is a substantive amount of literature written in this respect. And the evidence in this respect is quite contradicting, in the sense that, sanctions are considered to be quite ineffective by the majority of scholars. Nevertheless, when it comes to sanctions adopted against Russia, on the 3rd of March, a Reuters article reported that the sanction are starting having an effect on Moscow stock exchange market. In particular, the Russian Central Bank had to double his interest rate to 20%. So it seems that there is some evidence of effects of these sanctions against Russia. But I think we can be quite confident in saying that sanctions won't have an immediate short-term effect. Rather, in my view, the effect of sanctions will be tested in the long term when it comes to the economy of Russia. And in particular, talking about sanctions, I would like to focus briefly on the ban of Russia Today and Sputnik. So this is a very peculiar sanction that has been adopted against Russia on the 2nd of March, 2022, and basically consists in the banning of broadcasting activities by these two media outlets that have been instrumental in the propaganda for war against against Ukraine. So to my knowledge, this is the very first time that a sanction takes this form, where media outlets, media entities from other states have been prevented from broadcasting in the territory of the European Union. So there is an internal effect based on this sanction. So it's a sanction imposed on third country entities, but then the sanction applies in the territory of the European Union. We should say that this sanction is not, one can say, so innovative in the sense that other member states had already banned some Russian media. For example, since 2015, Lithuania and Latvia have suspended the broadcasting of the Russian language television channel RTR Planeta multiple times. And this decision was approved both by the Commission and later on in the Baltic Media Alliance case, the European Court of Justice recognized that countering incitement to hatred on account of nationality in the form of propaganda for war constitute a legitimate public policy objective. So it seems that the Court of Justice has considered as a valid justification that of countering propaganda for war by way of imposing sanctions. Now, I think that the imposition of this sanction by the European Union signals in a way that the European Union protects its internal democracies from misinformation that may hinder the very core of the founding values of the European Union, which include indeed also democracy. And in this sense, the balance that had to be struck in this context between freedom of expression that is protected under a number of instruments, such as the Charter of Fundamental Rights, Article 11 thereof, but also the European Convention of Human Rights, versus internal security, well, has tilted in favor of the second, of internal security, broadly understood. So in particular, Article 11 of the Charter of Fundamental Rights, we should recall, can be subject to limitation. So the restriction on fundamental on the fundamental freedom of expression is provided for by the Charter itself. And we should also mention that Article 52 specifies that any limitation imposed on fundamental rights in the European Union must be provided for by law and respect the essence of those rights and freedoms. Subject to the principle of proportionality, limitations may be made only if they are necessary and genuinely meet objectives of general interest recognized by the Union or the need to protect the rights and freedom of others. And it seems to me that both the general interest test and proportionality are met here in this context. Now, future questions before we move to
you want to still cover a bit of humanitarian aid?
Yes.
Maybe
sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. So, humanitarian aid then. So, I won't talk about the litigation of the sanctions, which I think is a very interesting question because there is the issue of whether Russia can actually challenge as an intervener these sanctions. But what about humanitarian aid? So that's a field that is quite interesting from EU law perspective, in the sense that it is a shared competence between the EU and the member states. So under Article 4, paragraph 4, TFEU, we read that both the EU and member states can adopt measures in this field. And this means in particular that the European Union has a supportive and a coordinating role in this field. The main legal basis for humanitarian aid is in particular Article 2014 TFEU, which tells us that precisely the Union measures and those of the member states should complement and reinforce each other. Any measure adopted in this field should be taken on the basis of a legislative procedure, ordinary legislative procedure, and the Commission has a coordinating role in this respect. So any measure that is adopted in this field, in the field of humanitarian aid by the European Union, shall respect the principles of humanity, neutrality, impartiality, and independence, and is delivered very often through the UN agencies, non-governmental actions, non-governmental organizations, and International Committee of the Red Cross. So what about the situation in Ukraine then? So we should mention, first of all, that since 2014, the European Union has been already active in granting humanitarian aid to Ukraine. And this meant, in a way, that the EU had already some instruments in place for supporting the situation in Ukraine. But what is quite interesting is that what has been used in order to facilitate humanitarian support in favor of Ukraine has been regulation 2021-832 on the Union Civil Protection Mechanism. And this is, interestingly, a regulation that has been adopted in 2021 to face the challenges of COVID. So an internal instrument, this regulation that concerns therefore how member states should deal with an internal crisis, in particular in this context, COVID, has been used externally towards Ukraine. So in this field, we can mention different different measures that have been adopted, in particular disbursement of significant amount of money towards Ukraine. The financial value of this assistance is estimated well above 100 million euros, but the assistance from the EU has consisted also in medical stockpile of the financial value of 10 million, and generally also support in terms of staff, humanitarian staff sent by the European Union. Now, I'm not going to cover the cohesion action for refugees in Europe because I think that Floris is going to cover this. But I think that what is particularly interesting now, concluding, is that, well, the measures that exist in the field of humanitarian aid that are intrinsically external in nature, in the sense that they are directed towards third countries, might have a spillover effect in a way in the management of emergencies within the European Union, and it would be interesting, therefore, to see how this aid also will impact the external aid will impact in a way on the finances, the internal finances of the Eurozone, and in particular, what is also quite interesting is the emergence of a notion of solidarity, not only internal but also external. So I will conclude here. Thank you very much, and I look forward to the discussion.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Julia. You've already given us an awful lot to think about. You've also reminded me of the fact that my colleagues always have so much to say that it might be a little bit difficult to discipline them. So we're going to do a little version of musical chairs. And you're going to move here. I'm going to sit next to Jan. And then after you've finished, I'm going to move right next to you. All right. Okay.
I start.
You start.
Hi, everybody. So as Berle has said at the start, I want to say a few words about national and the cultural dynamics that have been feeding into the EU's response that Julia started to describe. Forrest is going to speak about it in a second. And I think it's important because what we're often seeing happening at the EU level ultimately has roots in what's happening at the member state level, and sometimes even outside state structures. It has to do with something that non-state actors do. And I think a good place to start is Germany and Germany's policy shift, which has received a lot of media coverage here in the UK, but also internationally. Germany is the EU's largest member state. It is its economically most powerful member state. So it really matters what Germany does on issues like that. And what we've seen during the first weekend after the invasion was a really quite fundamental policy shift on many issues. Chancellor Olaf Scholz has called this a Zeitenwende. It's a term that's quite difficult to translate. It's a era change, a turn of eras, a turning point, but it has much more gravitas really in German. So something quite monumental is happening here. And there's many dimensions of this Zeitenwende, but I think the core ones of interest for discussion here are the military aspect and the energy aspect. So on the military side, for historical reasons, Germany has firmly rejected the idea that its arms and weapons could be used against Russian soldiers. And that, of course, is a result of World War II. This is still a specter, which is sometimes hard to understand for non-Germans, but it's a fear, it's a danger that's looming large in lots of Germans' minds. So here we've seen a real fundamental policy shift after this supplying of, I think, 5,000 helmets, for which Germany was rightly ridiculed in the international community. The chancellor has committed to provide Ukrainians with proper military equipment. So that's the first big change. The other big change concerns its funding of Germany's military, of the Bundeswehr, which is notoriously underfunded. And this has been pointed out by many allies of Germany. The 2% of GDP threshold of NATO was never really reached in recent history. Chancellor Scholz has announced that he's going to change that too. Actually, he's going to exceed that, that threshold. And why I think it matters is that having Germany, which has been a bit of a sleeping giant, or some people called a reluctant superpower in terms of geopolitics, awakening in that sense, it might have a really strong impact on EU policymaking. We know from the past that, especially in federal polities, crises often have this centralizing effect. They lead to centralization at the heart of the policy. So this could really have some spillover effects. Now on energy, I'm just going to say that Germany is much more reliant on Russian gas than many other European member states. And here too, we're going to see change. We don't yet know what this change is going to look like, but the infamous Nord Stream 2 pipeline has been first suspended, now I think effectively stopped. Germany's going to try to loosen up or lower its dependence on Russian gas, but here we have yet to see how that really happens and through which means. Now, second point I want to mention is the role of Central Eastern Europe in this conflict, and this has received far less media attention. Countries like Poland, the Baltic states, Slovakia, Hungary are geographically very close to the conflict, but they're also historically, culturally very close to the conflict, and therefore within the EU are going to be the most affected member states, no matter what happens in the war. And the relationship between Central Eastern Europe and the EU over the past few years has been incredibly difficult. I think it started with the strong backlash against the EU's refugee allocation policy in 2015-2016. Then came the rule of law crisis, the political changes in Hungary and Poland. Now we have a COVID relief fund, but Hungary and Poland's national recovery plans haven't been approved. I could go on. This war is happening right when things have gone really unpleasant. And still what we ended up seeing since the start of the invasion is that heads of state in the region, and here's especially Polish PM Morawiecki, have taken the lead, have pushed for EU measures, have planned and coordinated EU measures. This is an active policy shaping role we haven't seen in a while, maybe ever, actually, since these countries joined the EU. in my opinion, this this situation probably brings a few promises, but it also carries some risks. So I want to speak about the promise first, and it's precisely that, that we see an awakening, a regional awakening, so to say, that Central Eastern European policymakers are more actively involved with what's happening at the EU level in a constructive way, not just in a destructive way. And that might also mean, looking at the other side of things, that the Western European member states will take these positions a bit more seriously. And I don't think it gives anyone any pleasure to say this, but what's been happening since for the past 14 days is exactly what the leaders of all of these member states have been saying for three decades. And it was ridiculed by almost every single Western European member state. So there must be some shifts here. And I think they're both from the side of Central Eastern Europe, but also, also on the other side of the conversation. There are also some risks, and very briefly here. I think one major risk, and again, kind of sitting here in Britain, in the west of Europe, but also in the, it's an odd expression, but the global west for this purpose, there's a risk of lumping these countries together. And they are very, very different. Poland's stance on Russia has been always incredibly critical, of course, for historical reasons, but this has carried on through recent times too. Hungary has developed over the past 10 years a real privileged relationship with Russia and Putin. I've just listened to a Hungarian media expert on Saturday saying that apparently the Hungarian state news is running apologetic broadcasts about the war, saying that, you know, it's not really Russia's fault. There's Ukraine who's provoked that, and the EU as such. So between Poland and Hungary, there's a massive difference. And then we have all the other states, Slovakia, the Czech Republic, who are in between these two extremes. So so this is a diverse space politically. The other thing is that in this initial feeling of unity and justified unity, I guess, at EU level, we risk forgetting that we are still dealing to a large extent with authoritarian rulers. Poland and Hungary, although they've now taken, especially Poland, this positive role, the political situation within Poland hasn't changed. You know, the stuff that we've been decrying, the corruption, the rule of law crisis, the curtailing of democratic institutions are still there. And this is going to be an incredibly tough thing to navigate for the EU, because on the one hand, you need to have these countries and these political leaders on board. On the other hand, you cannot compromise or lose the perspective of protecting the rule of law, of protecting corruption, etc. A final thing I want to speak to is, and I've said this at the start, is the involvement of non-state actors. And this, I think, is something which everybody immediately realized, that this time around something was different. We had loads of private companies, we had loads of civil society organizations and other regional organizations taking a very strong stance, which is quite unusual. We haven't seen that in previous conflicts, even you know, in recent history. And I want to pick one example, which just happens to be an area that I know best, but I think it's also quite symbolic of what's happening, and that's football. FIFA and UEFA have adopted sanctions on the first weekend of the invasion. And what they've done is they've issued a joint statement in which they've declared that their solidarity with Ukraine and its people. But then also, and that's the operative part, so to say, they've announced that all Russian teams, whether national club teams, are suspended from participation in international competitions until further notice. The two notable targets of these sanctions so far are the Russian national team, who won't be playing Poland, you know, of all teams in the World Cup qualifiers, And there's Spartak Moscow, who won't be playing in the round of last 16 in the Europa League. And to clarify, FIFA and UEFA are not EU institutions. They're autonomous football governing bodies. So this is coming independently for them. And the strong reaction is quite unusual. We haven't seen anything like that in the past. UEFA and FIFA are traditionally extremely reluctant to take any political stance in any conflict in Europe and outside of Europe. And that's for a fundamental reason. They have in their statutes committed themselves to political neutrality. And this is the idea, of course, that sport is ideology free, that sport is a platform where people from opposing sides can come together and, you know, fight it out through peaceful means on the football pitch or whatever it is that you do. Because of this commitment, it's not actually quite clear whether, as a matter of law, FIFA and UEFA can adopt these sanctions. So far, what we understand, we've not seen official documents here, but it seems that they have relied on the so-called force majeure clause, so the unexpected circumstances clause. But the fundamental problem is here that you don't really have a provision in the UEFA or FIFA statutes which says if one of the member countries invades another state or initiates a war of aggression, you can throw them out of competitions. So we'll see there's some creative legal thinking around this topic where people have suggested UEFA and FIFA have also committed themselves to protecting human rights. So maybe that can be a counterweighing principle. But legally speaking, it's a different territory we're entering. And I don't think that's even the most interesting question this, and here's where I'm going to stop. I think this is just a, if anything, it's one out of many examples where a non-state actor has taken a stance in this conflict, and the effect of this might be symbolic, but what I think we're seeing over the past 2 weeks is that there can also be a cumulative effect once loads and loads of entities, companies, organizations are starting doing that, and the world of football is part of this.
Thank you very much, Jan, and also for the punctuality. Nevertheless, I'm still gonna make you some fun.
Well, I might escape that. Thank you, Vele. Thanks everyone for coming. Thanks for Jan and Julia as well. It's nice to see so many people, so many students of mine in the room as well. I also saw lots of names of former students on Zoom. So nice to see you in a way again. So I'll conclude with some thoughts on sort of the bigger picture, I guess. So what this has done to the EU so far in the last 2 weeks, but also in the longer term, because there's some developments that have started, which are likely to accelerate in the coming months and years and will really define the EU in the coming decades. So first of all, I think it's very important to say that I think it's difficult to overstate how much the EU owes Ukraine and the Ukrainians and their defense of values that have long been considered central to Europe and the EU, because I think it has given the EU the power and the motivation to also stand up for these values in much of it's done in the last 2 weeks. And much of the way it's starting to rethink its own DNA and the parts that are central to what makes the EU. So in one way, the EU is used to crises. We've had a crisis every 2-3 years of the last decade and a half. Those of you that studied the EU also know that the EU is not very good at dealing with crises, at least not initially. It takes a while to get going, partially it's due to internal disagreements. You need, particularly in external affairs, every member state on board, and member states have different interests, different alliances with different member states. Big powers, global powers, play off these member states against each other because they know that renders the EU incapable. So we're used to understanding the EU as an actor that has some power internally, but is relatively weak externally. There's even, I think, a Twitter handle which is quite popular, that is EU concerned, which collects all the statements by the institutions of being gravely concerned and deeply concerned and significantly concerned. Because that's what the EU does in external affairs. That's what they can agree on. Much further, they don't really go much further most of the time. This time is different. This time is the EU has done something that it hasn't ever done. It has moved in a weekend. It has moved through a number of taboos. It has moved forward decades worth of institutional changes and commitments. And there's a really nice saying in Dutch that translates literally as jumping over one's shadow. And that's what the EU has done. It has jumped across it in one go. It has just sort of got rid of its self-image, get rid of its understanding, and just moved to something else, like recast itself. And it has done so, I think, quite impressively. And you can really see now that the EU is, in fact, becoming a geopolitical actor. And this is not something that started this week or last weekend. This is something that people had anticipated was necessary for the EU. Luc van Middelaar, who those of you who do L232 remember from the first weeks, quite an influential thinker on EU in the EU space and widely read by people involved. Last year wrote a piece on the geopolitical union that we need to start thinking about the strategic interests of the EU and what that requires the EU to do and to be and how to transform itself. Macron has been beating his drum ever since he got elected. He got really frightened seeing what Trump did to the US and the US relation to the EU, making him realize that the EU needs a capacity to sustain itself in different ways, including militarily. And but all these processes that were sort of, there were undercurrents moving in that direction. So we've seen a big fund for the EU to manufacture its own chips, microchips. We've seen a $300 billion investment in Africa to try to sort of get the Chinese influence a bit away and get the European influence there. So we've seen the start of this geopolitical reality emerging. But the last 2 weeks, this has been sort of unprecedented. So we've heard from Julia, some of the measures have been taken, the sanctions, the SWIFT ban on the European, on the Russian Central Bank. There's a Ukraine recovery plan that's now being discussed up to the tune of 1.2 billion for the recovery of Ukraine. There's 450 million of military, direct military aid, which the EU has never done. This is on top of the military aid by the independent member states, using a mechanism that has never been used, an off-budget peace facility, again, never used. There's a commitment now to reduce Russian gas by 80% by the end of this year. Again, this would have taken, without this war, would have taken decades to get that far. And tomorrow and Friday, the EU leaders are meeting in Versailles, very powerful imagery there. And word on the street is that the big proposal by Macron and the Commission, who've clearly been talking about this, I'm gonna present it as a joint proposal, is a Repower EU fund to the tune of at least 200 billion. It's 200 billion that member states can use, the Commission can disperse to member states, and member states can use to create strategic independence in energy and military independence. So this is really something, again, unprecedented, the central borrowing from the EU to member states to make sure that in military terms, food terms as well, and energy terms, they're no longer dependent on outside states that might use this power to leverage the EU or prevent the EU from taking certain steps. So what does all this mean? So that's what's happened so far. But what does it mean for the EU and for the EU in the longer term specifically? So I think the EU received many compliments on the speed and the unity and the effectiveness of its move so far, especially, of course, relative to its weakness prior to the Russian invasion. But I think this indicates quite some significant shifts in the EU's understanding and the functioning. So the first one is that I think this is an important moment for the EU's purpose and its sense of meaning and identity. I think for those of you who followed the EU courses, we start in week one with a question, what is the EU for? And this was a question that was easily answered 40, 50, 60 years ago. Prevent war in Europe between European states, prosperity, internal markets. But those two projects sort of lost their appeal, partially because they've been so successful at it. We don't think that France and Germany are going to have a war at the EU ends, or that we're going to be all poor at when the EU ends. So the EU is not necessary for that anymore. So over the past decade or so, we've seen attempts of the EU to make itself relevant again. and has been very unsuccessful at that, actually. It's tried to do so by thinking of what do citizens want, what do they need, healthcare abroad, the cheap phone bills when they call somewhere else. You know, when your Ryanair flight is late, he gets some money back. You know, these were promised as, you know, we'll bring the EU back to the citizen. Well, now we have the start of two projects that makes the EU indispensable for its member states and citizens and are widely supported by them as well. So one is the energy transition, the Green Deal that started last year, that the Commission is very, very smartly embedding in all the recovery plans. So the recovery from the COVID plan, 750 billion, can be used by member states, but only if it's used to green the economy. The new MUTE that we'll be discussing in the coming days, Repower EU, same incredible amount of money that member states can use almost for free. But they have to be used for greening economies, for making them energy independent from oil and gas by Russia and other member states. So we now see these ideas of the EU serves for this energy transition, and it also serves to protect the interests of the member states and Europeans in a geopolitical sense in this scary world. We need a strong, smart, active, strategic EU. So the EU is pivoting, I think, and this will become more visible, I think, in the coming months and years, as presenting itself as being a central actor for these kind of projects. So it's no longer there necessarily for sort of the internal markets and to facilitate interaction between the member states internally, but to present a block externally for bigger projects, be it climate change or the geopolitical realities in the world. This also comes with a shift in institutional power. So again, we see the start of some changes that will probably become bigger and bigger. The big winner so far on the EU side, if that's an appropriate term in this context, are Emmanuel Macron, who is doing his status has shot up incredibly, both as someone who can engage directly personally with both sides of the conflict, but also as someone whose vision, basically he has been right for years. This is vindicating his vision as much as the vision of many of the Eastern European, Central and Eastern European states, their vision of the role of Europe in the world and the dangers to that role. The other big winner has been the Commission, that until a few years ago was really relegated as a minor institution, as an agent of the member states, powerful interests of the member states and the European Parliament as the embodiment of the citizens of Europe. The Commission has played an absolute blinder in this crisis. It has all the measures that we've discussed have come out of the Chamber of the Commission. They've been very fast, they've been very smart at pressuring member states and leveraging the member states to get things done. And the most painful reform for the EU in the next 30 years, the energy transition that's going to cost a lot of money to member states and to citizens, has for a large extent been brought forward in these two really, really big funds, the Next Generation EU fund, 750 billion, now another fund is being discussed in the coming weeks, which looks like it's going to be at least 200 billion, which is going to take the big sting out of this energy transition for many member states and for the EU as well. So that's really, really smart moving from the Commission that really sees itself as playing a much more important role in these external strategies that the EU might have. The loser so far have been Charles Michel. I don't know if you even heard of this guy, the president of the European Council, that looks like a very sort of powerful position in bringing the members, heads of the member states together. It's really been practically absent and really overshadowed by Macron and von der Leyen and the European Parliament. The European Parliament has, particularly in all these external questions, very little power, legally speaking. So it's becoming a very sort of symbolic actor in this space. Important, but more symbolic than as a crucial institution making calls. Now, internally, all these shifts also mean something for us as lawyers, as presumably many of us are. So we've taught you for the past year that the EU is predominantly something that happens through law. We integrate through law. The internal market are legal rules, you can't escape. The way we solve problems with Hungary and Poland is through law. That's the way we get European integration done. Now, the two big projects for the EU in the coming decades are not long, are the Green Deal and the geopolitical strategy. And both will be accomplished through money. Both will be accomplished through debt mutualization between member states and paying off those that are reluctant and subsidizing those constituencies within member states or within a citizenry that have to bear the cost of these changes. So that's a very, very important transition for the EU. It has always seen itself as a legal institution. Now it's becoming much more a traditional political actor, state actor, that buys compliance as well as forcing people into it. So if I'd have to speculate what this means for the EU, it means a lot more conditionality. So things will, member states will get money if they do X, Y, Z, green their economy, commit to rule of law, whatever it might be. So that will be a much more important strategy for the EU to get things done. In external affairs, we'll see a loss of vetoes. We've seen now that you can act quickly and can have a meaningful impact for goods in the rest of the world, which will come at a cost of member states losing vetoes in many of these external questions. And it will come, and the third development that is likely to happen is that we see that crises in the EU will now be solved by debt mutualization, something that until 2 years ago was absolutely impossible. Absolutely impossible for Germany, the Netherlands, Austria, Finland to commit to funding a European project. We've now seen it twice. The COVID crisis was solved that way. This crisis is likely to be solved that way, solved, held that way. So this has now become a go-to response for the EU in these crisis situations, which completely changes the picture of identity and solidarity across member states as well. Now, all of this was impossible a year ago, 2 years ago. There's a lot of momentum now. So I think the next few months will be a sort of solidification of what's happened and institutionalization of these powers. And I think in the longer term, we will really see a shift in what the EU is about. Now, I have 2 minutes left. Since Viola is sitting next to me, I can't escape that. So 1 minute on the refugee situation and 1 minute on Ukraine accession. We've seen over 2 million people cross into the EU since 2 weeks ago. Again, the EU's response have been incredibly fast. What they've done is that they've sort of resurrected a legislative agenda, a package that exists since 2001 that was drafted for the Balkan crisis, was never enacted. It's called the Temporary Protective Directive, Protection Directive, which allows the EU member states to sign off on essentially sort of generous conditions for entry and stay in the EU. So now for Ukrainians entering the EU, they can stay up to a year with housing benefits, medical insurance, the right to work and the right to live. This can be extended up to 3 years, something absolutely unimaginable when the refugee crisis happened in the Middle East, of course. There's a complete different treatment, different commitments to how we treat these refugees. Been very fast, it's been extended to third country nationals coming in from Ukraine, which was a problem at the border initially because Ukrainians had vis-a-vis travel in the EU already, so they could enter anyways, except that a South Korean living in Ukraine could not because of a different visa regime. Now, this directive allows all these people in anyways, so on the same conditions as Ukrainians, and really at the speed of light. So quite impressive. Again, the solution here will be buckets full of money will be thrown at the member states that have our housing and these refugees. Accession. Zelensky asked for accession, a very speed, fast accession. It will be discussed the next 2 days in Versailles. In the meantime, Moldova and Georgia have also asked to be member of the EU. This is not gonna happen. There's resistance for different reasons for member states. Ukraine or the other two don't meet the condition for entry. There's particularly concern about the corruption, level of corruption and the stability of the democratic institutions. The EU having been burned in Poland and Hungary is very reluctant to go too fast. These member states have to meet the acquis communautaire, which you all know is like thousands and thousands of directives and regulations need to be embedded in Ukrainian law before they can do so. But most importantly, now that the EU is a geopolitical actor, it understands also the geopolitical dangers of having membership of these countries. Because there's a lot of talk of NATO, but the EU also has a self-defense clause. If one EU member state is attacked under Article 42.7, all member states have to respond, including themselves. So that is the main reason why there might be a symbolic gesture that we accept that they are potentially a candidate member. but it won't go further than that. Which doesn't mean that the EU is not interested in responding to Zelensky and Ukraine's call for commitment to the European project. And again, this is something that Macron has been trying to get done for years, trying to imagine an EU where we have a core EU, not 27, 15, 16, Eurozone, deep integration military, deep integration fiscally, and then a surrounding, we'll come up with a nice name, the European Association, whatever you have, of states that want to be part of the EU, but not really, which might include member states that are very different, might include Turkey, Ukraine, but also the UK, Switzerland, Norway, and for different reasons, want an anchor, want to be anchored to the EU, want access to its market, but don't want to go much further than that. So again, if I have to speculate about a longer term, this is again a development that Russia's invasion of Ukraine seems to have sped up. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lewis, and thank you to all the speakers for really extremely enlightening and brief discussions. I'm going to open the floor to questions. And remember, short questions, please. Yes, over there.
Thank you very much. One tendency that I detected is that this is somehow a moment of consolidation for the EU, which it is, doubtless. But at the same time, it seems to me that the EU always acts in a very reactionary way, which you've noted. And I think that part of the issue with Russia is EU enlargement and NATO enlargement. So how in your opinion, the panel's opinion, how is it that the EU and I guess the global West, so including Canada, the United States, et cetera, how could have this been avoided rather than looking at this crisis in a retrospective way, in a prospective way, what could have the EU done differently?
All right, thank you very much. We're going to take
a few
more.
That's an easy one.
How could this have been avoided, listening to the Central European states? Okay, so that's one. Joe?
Yeah, we spoke quite a bit about the remilitarization of particular member states, but also of the European Union as a whole. And that to some extent is an old story, right? The rapid reaction force was spoken about 20 years ago, and there's always been a drive, and Macron's drive to militarize Europe. And I'm just wondering if the panel members think that that's an unqualified good, or if we need to be a little bit skeptical in the long run that Europe is thinking along military lines, acting as a rival to NATO or in collaboration with NATO, but it's not, I mean, this crisis notwithstanding, is this something to be welcomed or something to be wary of?
Okay, we're going to take one more. Let's see.
I just wanted to ask on the, because there was a point made of we will see more debt mutualization. In what regard we will need to anticipate constitutional courts reacting to that? I could see Karlsruhe having like a firm opinion on that, and whether that will potentially be a point of strong contention in the future, and how the EU should anticipate or deal with that.
Thank you very much, and let's try to be a little bit swift, succinct also in the answers, because I know that there's definitely a second round in here and you're still right, so let's kick off with how could this have been avoided? Jan, maybe you want to?
Yeah, sure. This is the $1 million question, I think. And I think part of the answer is to kind of maybe answer it from the wrong side. So partly the hesitancy and the kind of the now cost-benefit analysis we're seeing about sanctions, about putting pressure on Russia is that member states don't really, and not just EU member states, but countries across the world, don't really quite know where to get their gas from otherwise. I think that's a really banal but important part of this. So I think, this is not something you could have done over 2-3 years or nor over 5, but over 10, 20, 30 years. What definitely could have happened was a strategic independence and diversification of energy sources, so that, you know, if one closes down, then another, you know, light can be switched off, so to say. But maybe even more importantly, and I know this is politically not entirely uncontroversial, but the green energy agenda, people have been navigating this for now, what, half a century, and we could have done so much more, so much faster. And imagine if Germany had 40-50% of its energy from renewable sources, the response would look very different and the cost would be very different. The other thing is, and this goes a little bit into Joe's question already, is the defense aspect. And I do share your concerns. I don't think anyone is happy seeing this this happening. I do think it's probably unavoidable, to be perfectly honest. But in terms of Ukraine, in terms of the Baltic states, greater EU military and security cooperation, I think, would have gone a long way, just to kind of signal very early, well, this is a line you don't cross. And now thinking back, well, maybe in 2014, we should have been a bit more powerful in our response. Even, I think, more importantly, in 2008, when no one really took notice of what was happening in Georgia, maybe already that was a signaling moment when Putin was, you know, at the Munich Security Conference, kind of laying out his strategic priorities to say, oh, no, we're going to push back harder on this, and then increase the costs for the Russian side to do that in the future. But there's a lot of ifs and buts in this. But I think these are, from, you know, where I am standing, would be two important parts of the response.
I was actually wondering, Julia, if you want to add something to that, because I'm sure that, like, the sanctions are sort of like the soft end of the wedge, and remilitarization,
sure,
the hard,
sure,
end of the wedge, and how do they relate?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, sanctions are really weaponizing the context of the conflict in Ukraine. So in a way, the European Union is using almost a war language when it comes to adopting sanctions. And this is considered to be a way precisely to avoid militarization in a way. So using sanctions and therefore measures that do not involve conflict is a way for the European Union to not get into militarization. And I believe, and I think also clear, that the European Union is quite wary about this term. So it's true that projects on militarization of the European Union existed since the common defense project that existed in the late 50s, 60s. So, and this failed precisely because of the historical background of the European Union. I think that the question of militarization is strictly linked with money again. So I support Floris on this, in the sense that it's a choice about budget and allocation of resources. And now if we look at the budgetary rules in the European Union, well, the budget of the European Union is very limited in a way, if compared with budgets of states. So it means that militarization would require significant input of resources. And so I think that, again, whether this will be a development boils down to money, supporting Floris' point.
And with that, we're, you know, everything boils down to money. You want to talk a bit about
that
neutralization?
No, I think Joe's point, and also the first question, really, I think your questions indicate the answer in a way, that the EU has not wanted to do this. Mm-hmm. They don't want to do this.
Yeah.
It's in the DNA to avoid these difficult questions, controversial questions on militarization and what if and how do we do that. So it's always tried to not have to think about that.
Macron didn't want to do it before.
Yeah, but this is Macron. This is what, when did he get elected? 2017. This is a very short time span in the history of the EU. And part of the answer why how did they get so far is that answer. That's the EU has never been comfortable in that position. And now it's been forced to do that. And with it, it'll be forced to respond to these deeply controversial questions. Do we want a European army? And under which circumstances are we actually going to enter war? I mean, these are questions that we've always avoided when it comes to the EU, and now we'll have to start thinking about again. On Karlsruhe, this shows how much EU is law. That's, we immediately think, what is the German constitutional court going to think of our solution to the Russia crisis? But it's a very valid point. So the EU has very good lawyers, the Commission particularly. So how they've tried to get around Karlsruhe, so for those of you who don't know, German constitutional court been very critical of the way in which the debt to Eurozone crisis has been solved by giving the ECB, European Central Bank, lots of power to print money to deal with the monetary side of things. So what they've done with the COVID crisis, this fund of 750 billion, and what they'll do again if this gets adopted, is that this isn't something that the ECB does. It comes out of the own resources of the Commission, which is a legal technicality. But because of that legal technicality, formally speaking, the member states and the member state central banks are not liable for the costs. So it will be come up in Karlsruhe and in some other constitutional courts. But the argument against it is not as obvious as it was in ESM or T or quantitative easing.
All right, thank you. We're going to go to a second round now. We're going to take another three or so questions. Gary?
Yeah, can I slip two questions in here? maybe preface it with a comment, which is that Donald Trump had this habit of asking really good questions almost accidentally. And about 5 years ago, he said, well, what exactly is the point of NATO? And it didn't seem like there was a very clear answer at that juncture. Now there is. And in some ways, you seem to be answering a similar sort of question. But I have two other questions. One is a question, a comment for Jan about football. It strikes me, it's just as you were saying that FIFA and UEFA had been very apolitical, I started going through all these cases from the past and discovered or realized that, in fact, the game had been highly politicized. We threw Yugoslavia out of the European Championships. We have a World Cup in Qatar. And the example I'm really curious about was the case where the Soviet Union refused to play Chile in a World Cup qualifier after Allende was removed. The Scottish football team disreputably did go to the stadium where the tortures were taking place to play a friendly, but the Soviet Union was then expelled from the World Cup as a result of that. So there's a kind of a counter history of politicization, which is rather interesting here. But my real question was provoked by the screen where all these sort of Freudian comments kept coming up. So there were all sorts of mistranslations. What, the division of Europe was translated as the division of Europe. And at one point when somebody said the EU is not very good at dealing with crisis, it came up as the EU is not very good at dealing with Christ. And that got me thinking about the idea of the Antichrist, because in 1917, the Kaiser was presented to us as a kind of Antichrist. And of course, two things happened. One is that we decided to set up an ad hoc tribunal for the crime of aggression to prosecute the Kaiser, who was the arch criminal of Europe and had engaged in this utterly unprovoked war that had nothing to do with inter-imperial rivalries or disarmament or the economic competition between states in Europe. And we have applied sanctions to Germany. Are we in a 1917 point in history?
Another easy one.
All right. Okay. So 1917. All right. I know there's another question out there, but there's. I'm first going to take your question.
Just to keep it short. Given the demands of further integration that have been discussed, and how much more money and that it demands, what are the prospects for a fiscal union given the context in Ukraine?
Prospects for a fiscal union. Yeah. Okay. Excellent. Thank you. Nice and pithy. David.
Thank you, Ewan. Thank you all for really amazing conversation. So this goes to Florence in a way. To what extent are you concerned that your account of the future development in reaction to the invasion is too Panglossian, really? It seems they'll throw money at it. It's going to happen through throw money at it. You know, it seems like there's so many barriers to what you're describing in the way. So the mutualization of the cost of this. So I don't think that is clear, right? We're just coming out of COVID. Balance sheets of many member states are in a really bad way. Can we be sure that even rich countries whose balance sheets are in a bad way will indeed mutualize debt? I'm not sure. Are we sure that member states will buy into the nuclearization of power that might be needed to make this this happen. So there seems to be a lot of really significant barriers. So I'm wondering whether you're too fun-glossing. And then the second question I had was, so I'm taking Gary's approach. These are actually two questions, not six. In relation to the militarization of Europe, I'm not sure how it's going to work. Right? Most member states are small countries. Spending 3 or 4% of GDP on the military is not going to be able to enable them to provide independent, powerful enough militaries to defend themselves. It has to be mutualized as well. But it's not clear to me how that can happen. And that also seems to me to be such a significant barrier to what you described.
Right. Okay, so lots of questions that actually sort of allude to potential barriers for this kind of new vision of Europe to materialize. Would anyone like to kick off with one of Gary's embarrassment of riches?
I mean, I'm happy, obviously, to take the football question. I'll let you deal with the hard stuff. Good point. And it's true. I've been doing that exercise, too, over the past years. And I mean, the Yugoslavia example is, of course, the kind of the big example, also because in football terms, it ended up, you know, really affecting the outcome of that tournament. Now... Still, we remember this because it's quite exceptional. If you think about the past few years, last year, it feels like a decade ago, during the Euros, there was this really quite low level, if you think about it, dispute between the Munich Stadium and the kind of German Football Federation and UEFA, because they wanted to light the Allianz Arena, home of Bayern Munich, in the LGBTQ colors in the rainbow flag. Now, this was prohibited as an infringement of political neutrality. And many people there commented, well, that's really weird, because one of the official actually slogans and aims of UEFA is to you know, promote equality, to combat anti-discrimination. And on a slightly higher level, we've had a dispute a few years back with the Israeli Football Association for admitting teams that are located in the occupied Palestinian territories. There again, FIFA said, look, we can't really do anything based on our law. Now, so thinking kind of from that side, these small little political things were found to be too controversial to take a stance on, even though I think they were really easy ways to make to take a stance, whereas, you know, here the reaction was so immediate and oddly also much faster than many other international and regional organizations. So something's happening. Qatar, I think, is not quite the same, because, you know, of course there's a lot of politics in football, governance, and there's a lot of money involved, there's a lot of corruption, but it's usually kind of politics of the kind that, oh, we're getting too close to rulers who the rest of the world might find a bit questionable. It's not this direct taking a stance in a conflict, telling this and this country that they've done something wrong, or that and that country that they've something right. It's more this kind of schmoozing. And so I think this is very different. This is a kind of in your face type reaction to a national government. So yeah, I think it is slightly different.
Right. I mean, it seems to me the second and third question about, you know, fiscal union, money, etc. I have a sense that they close that they connect quite a bit to Flora's topics, but I first wanted to make sure that Julia, if there is a comment you would
like
to...
on Gary's comments, what's the point of NATO? I guess it acts as a safety net, as a almost in this context, it feels like a psychological threat. So there is NATO, but then triggering it, it's a different question, and clearly shows also the ineffectiveness in a way of NATO, one can say, in this context. But of course, there isn't a direct attack to the European Union and states of the European Union. So of course, the conditions to trigger NATO are not there. But again, it's in this context, it feels that it acts as a psychological safety net in this field. But then going back to the point of sanctions and specialized tribunal, I think that I don't think we're living the same era. I think things are changing in the sense that when it comes to economic sanctions in particular, the accent is much stronger now, for example, compared to the past. Whether, of course, it depends what's the objective, of course, of sanctions, for example, and what is the real goal that we try to pursue, for example, through sanctions. So, of course, there can be an economic impact because that's what the sanction is about, in particular in the context of Russia, but these clearly are instruments that do not end the war. So so again, it's there is a mismatch between purposes and instruments. On the fiscal aspects, just very briefly, I think I agree with the point of David, but I believe this supports. I think that COVID has put strain on budgets and member states' politics are affected deeply in their finances. So I'm not sure that this is going to happen in the very short term.
I'm going to turn to Florence in just a second, but I just wanted to flag up for the people watching online that if you want to also contribute a question at this point and write something in the chat, I'll have a look at it as Florence is answering the set of questions.
Thank you. Thanks for the question, Gary. It's nice that you come up with questions based on the translations. I saw veal being translated as bear. Let's see what it does there. Veal again. Is it 1917? Yeah, let's go for it. Yeah, we have this Antichrist. We have that even managed to get all 27 member states in line, which has never happened before. We have this highly symbolic meeting in Versailles over the next 2 days where the EU is trying to rediscover itself in opposition to something else. So yeah, I mean, this might well be the moment when we look back at it, where we say this is when something fundamentally shifted.
But 20 years later, we had 1939.
I know, I'm well aware of it. This is not in my roadmap for the future of Europe either. But you know, these are events that are unfolding, and there are some striking similarities, as you say. Now, on the prospect of fiscal union and David's questions as to, you know, aren't there many steps and hurdles to be taken legally, economically, practically? Absolutely. So to the extent that we have debt mutualization at the moment, it's both within the Next Generation EU fund post-COVID and the new Repower EU. It is both time limited. So the Next Generation 2027, I think, and this one will be 2030. It is limited to an amount of money. It's also limited amount of money per member state. And that money is partially a loan and partially grants. So partially it's actually debt mutualization. So partially it's a loan has to be repaid, formally speaking, by the member state. So the sort of resistance by the so-called fiscal hawks in Germany, Austria, Finland, Netherlands have been built in that process. So Macron and Draghi wanted sort of an open debt mutualization. So both these limits have been built in to the point that now that they're discussing a new project, they're already there from the proposal onwards. So it's clear that these things, there will never be a fiscal union that's indefinite, that comes without conditions. So the conditions, what you can use the money for, is very, very strict. The conditions, for example, now they're, I mean, this is all up for discussions. I just know someone who's involved in the preparations, and they say that one of the things that are very clear is that when it comes to spending on military or energy for this new package, it has to be a transnational arrangement. It's not, member states can't go their own way. It has to be coordinated. So Austria can spend on a part of the military equipment, but then other member states spend on something else. And I think at least when it comes to your question on the military side, you're completely right. Obviously, it does make sense for each member state to have a little bit of everything. So this is what I mean when we think if EU were to move to this geopolitical actor, it comes with all these questions that we actually are uncomfortable asking and answering. That yes, that we can have a significant military presence that's available as a defensive or offensive action, but it has to be collective. That's the only way in which this can happen, which solidifies the EU in one way, but also creates very problematic questions about who gets to decide these things, what are the effects, and how do citizens feed into this process. I'll leave it there.
Okay,
can I just come in on that? That's what we have NATO for. So what would EU militarization add that NATO already doesn't cover? And if NATO isn't getting involved in this war, and we saw last night that it doesn't want anything to do with it, what would the EU military do in response that NATO doesn't? It would be just as hesitant.
No, so the idea is very much this. The birth of this idea of an EU as a military actor comes from Trump's question. What if Trump is re-elected again? You know, NATO is not going to come to defense if there's three boots on the ground in the Baltics. So we need, even if we never use it, we need the ability to assert the European interests, or to project the European interests, ideally in combination with other global powers, but if necessary, also without support of those actors.
Okay, I'm going to, I guess we do have a good online question that I would like the panel to turn to. So Russia has threatened that it might respond to EU sanctions by nationalizing EU businesses and assets. What legal remedies does the EU have, and does the EU possess the legal means to nationalize Russian businesses and assets? And as I'm reading it out, a second question pops in by a certain Mrs. Michaela. To what extent do we think the, oh my goodness, to what extent do we think the EU is assisting Ukraine with making decisions about which peace arrangement to accept? And then the final question that we can take, and that will be the wrap up, is a European army possible at this point? Well, Rachel, if we get to you, great, but I'm not making any promises at this point. But let's focus on the first two, given that I think the third one's already had a bit of an airing at this point. So,
Should I, please, Julia? And so that's a very interesting point. And I think that in principle, as far as I know, there aren't really some legal mechanisms that exist in this field and remedies for this, unless one can think of extraordinary measures or an international agreement between the member states in this field to achieve this result, unless, of course, there is an agreement reached through EU institutions. But that's a very good question, and I think that this goes a bit perhaps back to what Dr. Gary was asking. So what is going to be the reaction of Russia in a way and to sanctions? And I think these are emerging questions that I think will require a political, even before than legal, mechanisms to be successfully addressed.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'll just be very brief. I think it's, probably in theory, at least our international trade law friends, you know, would have something to say about this. And although I wonder, as much, Floris has mentioned this before, within the EU, law plays a massive role in this conflict, although maybe less so now. I think it's going to be a tougher situation when we speak about Russian domestic law coming from the outside or trade relations with Russia. My feeling is ultimately there's going to be a political solution to that. Eva's question, I don't know. I actually don't have any expert knowledge. Maybe your friend or colleague will know something. My feeling would actually be that in addition to supplying some kind of general knowledge and diplomatic know-how, it's actually going to be the Ukrainians who are going to call the shots here, and partly because of the way in which the conflict has developed. And very quickly to Luca's question, who's one of our L232 students, I mean, on the European army, we've touched on this, and David has asked a question, Floris has answered. Just one point, which maybe other than the mere technical stuff, who's going to get which fighters and artillery, etc. I think one of the issues will also be And we forget that we still have some EU member states who have a strict neutrality policy, right? I mean, I'd be curious to hear Swedes, for instance, you know, discussing the prospect of an army in their name going into another country and you know, fighting. So I think in addition to the technical and kind of coordinating issues, we'll have a real conversation here about how to make that happen. You know, countries who've had a long history of like France, you know, of being involved in conflicts, and other countries who really don't want to do that for historical reasons.
Yeah, so I mean, I think with the Lucas question, sort of, yes, an European army of some sort will emerge, and not one decentralized European army. It'll be cobbled together by different member states that want to do something. The much more difficult question is, will it ever be deployed, and under which conditions and in which situations? That's a question that's infinitely more difficult than politically, you know, dynamites. Might lead to the implosion of the EU. These kind of essential questions. And now, very briefly,
can you just briefly, because we have a minute and a half, so I would like to just give, if we can pay a little bit of attention to Rachel's question, mm-hmm. which is basically, you know, like this existence of this supranational mm-hmm. structure, is this actually kind of helping to de-escalate, or mm-hmm. is it actually poking the bear in a much more frightening way than would have happened if the EU hadn't been there on the doorstep? So if you could give your very brief assessment on that, and we're going to close off the session with that. Yes, go ahead, Julia.
I think in principle it's helping the escalating, but that's again, it depends on the perspective, I would say, because I think this directly goes into how Russia then is responding to it. And even though, of course, I mean, the international law at this point hasn't had a very immediate effect, in the longer term, it might escalate, but there would be huge sacrifices paid, mostly by Ukrainians. So that would be my answer to this question.
Yeah, I mean, I anyone's guess is as good as ours, probably. But actually, my feeling is maybe slightly different. I have more of the feeling that the kind of the legal instruments we've been seeing, the EU legal instruments in particular, I'm not sure they lead to de-escalating. It feels more that you can't go to war realistically here, so it's doing everything it can. In terms of economic, financial, cultural, regulatory sanctions, it can. And it hasn't done yet everything. It hasn't reached the kind of the full potential. But I'm actually not sure if it's having a de-escalating role, but I do think that many people think it's a justified intervention into this conflict.
Yeah, and mine, again, is slightly different, maybe a good way to end this. I think Ukrainian's geographical position is a problem mm-hmm. to an extent that has its face with, and its citizens and its projections and aspirations are torn to two sides between what the EU has very successfully projected, this project of sort of freedom and democracy. It isn't always like that, but it's projecting that, and it's been committed to sort of expand its geographical reach. So it's made promises to Ukraine as well with the accession treaties. So there is, they fed this potential and this aspiration, and the EU must commit to that as well. And on the other hand, of course, we have a very different vision of Ukraine's future. And Ukrainians, I think Jan very rightly say that this is a decision that will have to be made by Ukrainians. And if that decision is that they want to strengthen ties with the EU, I hope the EU does everything it can to commit to that promise.
Okay, thank you very much. And with that, I will close off the session now. Thank you all very much for joining us. We have a host of events. We have some blogs on the law school website already. We have a newsletter, and also we have another event right here tomorrow evening, which I think will be chaired by you, David, on the effect with Jonathan Fisher on the effectiveness of sanctions. At what time is that?
That's right, it's 3:30 to 4.
That's at 3:30 tomorrow. So thank you for your engagement. Thank you to our excellent panel of speakers, and good night.